Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday the 4th of September, our IFA special. And joining me on this edition, our assistant editor, Steve Withers.
I didn't know you were Italian.
And audio reviewer, Ed Selly.
It could be pernicious anemia.
So, like I say, it's the IFA special. However, myself and Ed didn't go to IFA. So Steve will be doing most of
the Steve Withers special then, isn't it?
It's a Steve Withers is special every week, is it not? But before we go ahead, just a quick RIP, because we lost Toby Hooper, best known for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Steve, and Poltergeist.
Yeah, well, apparently directing Poltergeist, although obviously there are lots of stories about Spielberg being heavily involved, and when you look at the final film, it does feel very much like a Spielberg movie, but definitely directed Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was a seminal film in the 70s in terms of horror, you know, really groundbreaking. Not violent or bloody at all, in fact, although everyone thinks it is. If you actually watch the film again, you realise there's almost no blood and very little violence actually in the film. It's all just atmosphere, and it is an incredibly atmospheric film shot with a very documentary feel, and it is, you know, it is a film that will affect you when you watch it. It's something that I can imagine in the 70s must have been, you know, like a dropping a bomb in the middle of the cinema, the way that it must have affected the audiences then, but it's still effective even now over 40 years later.
Probably one of the first sort of really real psychological thriller horror type films, isn't it, really? You know, it plays on all the tropes and all the fears of, you know, the youngsters out on a joyride, a road trip, and it suddenly just goes all wrong. And the scary thing was it was based on a true story as well.
Yeah, Ed Gein, wasn't it? Based upon Ed Gein.
And
I think the production design is a big factor in the film, because the house itself is somewhere you just would never, ever want to go. There's something horribly creepy and unsettling about the entire film, but particularly the house with all the flesh-covered, you know, lamps and that sort of stuff.
And again, some of that was based on reality as well.
Yeah, exactly,
some of the stuff that they found at crime scenes and so on. So it just makes it even more scary. The thing is, you know, generations now, or the newer generations, are going to look at it and think, well, what's the big deal? Because like you say, I mean, horror movies nowadays, even 15 Certificates, we discussed this a few weeks ago, you know, the amount of violence and bloodletting and, you know, headshots with blood and brain splatters and all the rest of it, you kind of get desensitized to that kind of thing. So I could see generations now looking at this and thinking, well, what was the big fuss?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing about the film, though, is that because it's not really about gore and violence and that's something that we've become unfortunately rather desensitized to, because it's about this overwhelming sense of dread the entire time. I think it might still be quite effective, because that's something that you don't necessarily, well, hopefully you don't get used to feeling uneasy and full of dread all the time. So I think it will still work. Unfortunately, obviously, it's been diluted over the years by numerous sequels and prequels and remakes. Interestingly, Toby Hooper did direct Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which was really, really gory. It was the absolute opposite, in fact, of it was more of a comedy with shed loads of gore in it. And some people describe it as like watching a car wreck, with a manic performance from Dennis Hopper. But I mean, we remembered for Texas Massacre, and quite rightly so. I think it is a seminal film. Obviously, Poltergeist is a popular film with people of our generation. And of course, he did do the TV version of Salem's Lot. After that, though, I've got to say, his career, we did Life Force, which is a particular favourite of mine, but not for any reason to do with horror or science fiction. If you've seen the film, you'll know what I'm talking about. I've got two words to say, Matilda May.
Did you have it on VHS, Stephen? Was it well worn?
The pause button was broken on my VHS recording. but his career, let's be honest, his career since then has definitely not been particularly stellar, which is a shame. But he's still, you know, if you've only made, you know, those three films I just mentioned, or even four films if you include Life Force, I mean, that would be that'd be enough for most directors. And it's been a bad year, isn't it, for horror directors, because obviously George Romero died not long ago as well, so it's a shame. He wasn't that old either. So, real shame.
You're getting worried again, Steve, now you're in your 50s.
I'll tell you what, they are getting closer and closer.
A few podcasts to do yet, Steve. You'll be fine. Right, so Ed's going to tell us all about competitions before we move on.
Oh, good. Hang on. Let me bring the running order back up. Right, you can win a pair of NAD Viso HP30 headphones, courtesy of Seven Oaks Sound and Vision. That competition closes on the 20th of September. That's the open competition at the moment.
And do you have any previous competition winners that are more than none?
Contain yourself. We do. Joe Pineapples won the Zerotech Dobby Mini Selfie Quadcopter, which is a pretty cool prize. And HMHB won the Scan Cedia Luxury Gaming Chair. And that's great, because those are two members that I actually have heard of. I think I even may have met one of them. That's quite cool.
There you go.
So well done them both.
Yeah, congratulations to them on the competition win. Right, let's move on to hardware news. It's going to be IFA heavy, but before we get into the main IFA news and what was announced and discussed at the show a few days before, Samsung, Panasonic, 20th Century Fox announced their partnership to develop HDR10+. We're going to get into it. Steve's going to give us, because obviously Steve's heard it from the horse's mouth now, he's going to give us all the details. But this was something that we saw back at CES. It was kind of brushed over a little bit and rushed in terms of presentation-wise. It was kind of, oh yeah, and this is what we're also doing, when we saw Samsung at CES earlier in the year. Now coming to market for 2018. And this is license-free, it's royalty-free. The problem is it's probably coming to market a bit too late, Steve.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, this, because like you say, Phil, I mean, we've known from meetings with Samsung, they've been working on this for some time. And they announced it at CES officially, and then there was another announcement earlier in the year when Amazon sort of said they're going to do something with Samsung in terms of their app on Samsung TVs that would support HDR10+. But this suddenly, out of nowhere, we've got this partnership or alliance, if you like, of Samsung and Panasonic and 20th Century Fox. Now, 20th Century Fox's involvement is not a surprise, because they've been very tight with Samsung throughout this whole Ultra HD Blu-ray launch. And so I was not surprised at all that they are going that way with Samsung in terms of adding HDR10+. But Panasonic's an interesting one, because, you know, they could have gone either way. There's been a lot of talk about them going with Dolby Vision. And I know a lot of members have been asking that question and hoping that they would. So that was an unusual one. And I got the feeling, having met with them at IFA, that they've kind of announced this, but there's very little substance yet. It's all sort of like, yes, we're gonna create, and we're gonna develop HDR10+. You know, we're gonna add it to Ultra HD Blu-rays and for streaming. It's gonna be on our TVs. That Panasonic are gonna do a backwards, gonna do a firmware update for 27 TVs. I should stress that means they are not updating the DX902. That is a 2016 model that will not be getting an update, but they will be updating the 2017 models from the 750 up. So that's their intention. That Samsung have already announced that they're going to be upgrading their TVs as well. I think they will include last year's, actually, in the case of Samsung. So they've obviously had this in development for much longer. And then Fox talking about using it for streaming and for discs. Now, I should stress that currently HDR10+ is not part of the Ultra HD Blu-ray specifications. There was a guy from Panasonic in the meeting I was at who said, you know, we're on the board of the BDA, it will be added. But I met with the BDA the following day, and I was talking to Victor Masuda, who is the, you know, the chairman of the BDA, and he said, I've been hearing a lot of stuff about, I asked him about HDR10+, he said, I've been hearing that people have been saying things about it's going to be added really soon. And I said, yeah, I can tell you exactly what Panasonic said. This is what the guy said. He said it'd be added by the end of the year. And Victor said, well, that's not true. He said, we need to get the agreement of all the members. I said, that's really, really not true at all. I mean, this has just been announced, and that will take a lot longer than by the end of the year. So he seemed to think that it's not a done deal at all. That doesn't surprise me. I mean, you know what any committee's like, yeah? Trying to get 20 or 30 manufacturers to all agree on something is never easy. And I can see it taking longer than just a few months. So at the moment, it's not even included in the Ultra HD Blu-ray specs. So the idea of any discs being released with it is definitely going to take some time. Definitely.
Now the big thing here, Steve, is what exactly is HDR10+? So were you told exactly what it is this time around and what it does?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, it's an addition to HDR10, the normal one. So what they're adding now is dynamic metadata, which basically means rather than having a set number for the peak brightness of a film and the sort of black level of a film, so say it's 0 nits and 1,000 nits for sake of argument, and that applies to the entire film. What they're doing with dynamic metadata is you actually adjust that from scene to scene, and you could even do it from frame to frame if you needed to. And the idea is obviously to optimize the performance for each scene, so that the whole film looks better than it would if it was just done with HDR10, where you had only one setting for the entire movie. They did show some demos actually on the Panasonic stand. They had a particularly effective bit, which was a waterfall. And the HDR10 version, obviously, it was bright, but in the HDR10+ version, there was a lot more detail in the waterfall itself. So that's the idea. The idea is that it gives you a more effective and more optimized and more efficient way of delivering HDR10. And where it's particularly useful are less capable displays. So if your TV does 1,000 nits or over 1,000 nits, it's not really an issue, particularly with 1,000 nit encode. But if your TV isn't capable, say it's only doing 400 or 500 nits, then it becomes an issue. And so that's the idea behind it. Now, the problem with Dolby Vision is, of course, because there's licensing fees involved, it's only really being included with higher-end models. And the idea that Samsung and Panasonic wanted to put across was the idea that, you know, because they could do a free, you know, open platform that would be free with no licensing, you could then use it on lower-tier models as well. And therefore, it would add greater value to consumers. And I don't disagree with that. I think that's actually a very valid point. You know, where it would add more, add greater impact, would be on cheaper TVs with less capable backlights and less and lower peak brightnesses. And so that makes sense.
I guess the other advantage of this, and obviously it's an advantage of Dolby Vision at the minute, is tone mapping has to be the same right across the board. So you won't see variations as we do at the minute when it comes to tone mapping the content to the screen's capabilities.
You mean variation from manufacturer to manufacturer?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. The thing about Dolby Vision is it's essentially the same thing. It's essentially adding metadata to the image, but obviously it's a closed ecosystem, and they have the Dolby Pulsar monitor. They know exactly how it's encoded, how it was graded, etc., and then that's carried through to the disk or the streaming service and then delivered to the TV, and the TV can be calibrated. So you get a completely closed ecosystem where you know exactly what you're getting from beginning to end, and it's all, as you say, it's all consistent. There is no difference in terms of how it's being tone mapped, and obviously you have the dynamic mesh data as well to enhance the performance from scene to scene. All good. The problem is that certain manufacturers, and by that I mean basically Panasonic and Samsung, don't necessarily want to hand over their HDR performance of their TVs to a third party, which is essentially what you're doing when you take on board Dolby. Not obviously, you also have to pay them licensing fees, but I think it's less about the money and more about the lack of control. Panasonic were keen to stress that they felt they could you know innovate more if it was them doing it. That they felt that they were really good with colors and they didn't want to rely on Dolby. And I understand that to a degree. I mean, it's never easy to give up control. Look what happened when Philips and Sony took on board Android TV and they had nothing but delays and issues with it. So I can completely understand that principle. But the ultimate problem is, like anything, any kind of, and it's, I mean, suppose we could call it a format war. They were very keen to stress this is not a format war. And I'm thinking, well, it is though, isn't it? Because you've got Fox only doing HDR 10 plus and every other studio is doing Dolby Vision and you don't have a TV that does both. And, you know, or even if it did, you still would have to, you know, you have a player that does both.
It's not quite a format war though, because everything has to be based on HDR 10 anyway. I mean, even yes, Dolby Vision is based on HDR 10. You know, that was their development and they made it open source. So everything's based on that standard. But what you're saying is one's going to be licensed, one isn't licensed. They're going to have to be graded differently because, well, that's built into the Dolby ecosystem. That's the whole supposedly big point of Dolby Vision is it goes right from the camera to what you see on your screen at home, and it's consistent all the way through because everything is done in the Dolby Vision chain and looked at, and it has the dynamic metadata and all the rest of it. Open source is great, but again, you're going to have different grading suites, different grading studios going to do things differently.
Exactly. Now, we did actually meet with a colorist as well from Deluxe, who seemed to feel that having an extra pass wasn't a big deal. It would actually be relatively straightforward to do another one. So you're already doing one for SDR, one for HDR10, one for Dolby Vision, one for Dolby Vision in the cinema. And also, you know, you could do another one for HDR10+. So he didn't think it would be a big deal in terms of workflow. So it really comes down to support, doesn't it? I mean, like any kind of, not trying to use the word format well, but, you know, when you're talking about different formats, the one with the most content is generally the one that wins.
And which one's winning at the minute?
Well, if you look at studios that support Dolby Vision, first of all, Dolby Vision is already part of the Ultra HDBlu-ray spec, so tick for Dolby there. Secondly, you've got studios Sony, Paramount, Universal, Lionsgate, all support already, and Disney Disney and Warner's do already support it in terms of streaming, so it's a fairly safe bet they're going. In fact, I asked the Warner's guy. I met with the Warner's guy on Friday, and he said yes, we will be doing Ultra HD Blu-rays with Dolby Vision as well. So it's a fairly safe bet that we're going to have all those studios doing Ultra HD Blu-rays with Dolby Vision, as well as streaming with Dolby Vision as well. Netflix obviously use Dolby Vision worldwide. I know that Amazon use Dolby Vision in the States. On the HDR 10 Plus side, you've got Fox, who are supporting it. That's it. Moment on Studios. And also, I know Amazon made an announcement earlier in the year about doing it on their streaming service. Although, interestingly, Amazon were very conspicuous by their absence in this whole alliance thing. You know, no one mentioned that, Amazon at all. So I don't know what's going on with that relationship. But yeah, you can clearly see that at the moment, Dolby Vision has a big head start. You know, there are already players in the marketplace that do it. So you've got the two Oppos and the LG. You've already got TVs in the marketplace that support it, from LG. Toshiba obviously just recently announced they're going to be doing it. Lerva do it. Sony, of course, will be doing it soon. I think Bang & Olufsen are doing it because they're using an LG TV. So there's quite a few manufacturers that already support Dolby Vision. I think TCL use it in China. And on the other side, you've got two manufacturers who are supporting it and no players, and it's not in the specs. And yeah, so it's definitely skewed heavily right now towards Dolby Vision. How things will play out going forward, we don't know. I mean, if Elsa Studios come on board and say, oh, okay, this is great, it's cheaper and easier and we want to do this, then fine. But I think my personal opinion is what is already a very complicated subject that consumers are struggling to understand. This does not help, does it? This just muddies the waters even more. And we start thinking about things like passive and active 3D. You know, that didn't help things, did it? So I just wish they'd all get together, agree on one way of doing it and get on with it. Because all we want at the end of the day is the best possible experience, don't we?
You mentioned 3D, Steve. You'll have started something now. Should never talk about that.
The outrage bus is firing itself up and getting ready to go. Can I just have one possibly banal observation about this? But as a partnership, now I take on board the comments about this potentially being quite beneficial for lower brightness televisions. And that makes perfect sense to an extent for Panasonic and their range of high specification OLEDs where they're going for color naturalness, so on and so forth. That strikes me as something that's the absolute handbrake on a rowing boat for Samsung. I was under the impression that their televisions were bright enough to sort of burn shadows onto the wall.
That is actually true. And I personally suspect that Samsung's, whilst I think Panasonic were being genuine and honest when they said that, I think that Samsung's resistance is down to licensing fees and probably more specifically control. And also I think there's a degree, I don't know about anybody else, but when you're the biggest manufacturer in the world, there's a degree of, I think, arrogance that comes with it, just totally being in that position. Sony used to be like that, didn't they, once upon a time, always doing their own thing and they were going in a different way. Now with Blu-ray that worked out quite well in the end, but you know, it's a risky thing to do, and at the moment Samsung, who have had a challenging year from what I've been hearing from other manufacturers while I was at the show, very challenging year in terms of product pricing, market share. It seems like they obviously decided to do their own thing and they're going to go their own way, and they think they're big enough and strong enough and powerful enough to do that. We'll see. But
I think there's anything wrong in the principles of what they're doing. You know, making it free for everybody, no licensing, royalty free and all the rest of it. And, you know, but kudos to them for doing that, because, you know, they won't be collecting license fees, although if you actually read the small print, they will be collecting some fees.
So there will be somewhere in there.
if you actually read some of the press releases, there are fees to be paid by manufacturers and so on. But, you know, kudos to them for doing that, but it's too little too late from where I'm sitting at the minute and looking at this.
I mean, what we could see is a situation that we are seeing in terms of soundtracks on Ultra HD Blu-rays, for example, where if the film has a Dolby Atmos soundtrack at the cinema, that is being ported across to the disc. If the film didn't have a Dolby Atmos soundtrack at the cinema, then the studios have an option of either doing a Dolby Atmos mix or no mix at all, just using a DTS HD Master Audio mix, or doing a new DTS:X mix instead. And some studios are doing Dolby Atmos, so, like, for example, Sony do it for all their discs, regardless of whether it had an Atmos mix at cinema or not. But Universal, for example, if it's cinema Atmos mix, they use that. If it didn't have an Atmos mix at cinema, then they do a DTS:X mix instead. We might see studios doing that. Maybe if they've got a Dolby Vision grade already done for the cinema, they might just, you know, port that across to the disc. And if they didn't do one for the cinema on a movie, then maybe they'll just do a HDR 10 Plus grade instead, because it'd be cheaper. Possibly that might happen. Who knows? But it's just, from my perspective, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, well, I've got a Dolby Vision player, Dolby Vision TV, Dolby Vision discs. I've already got that metadata.
Yeah.
It's there. It's in the home.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Okay, let's move on. So there's lots more than just this at IFA this year. Although I've got to say, the problem with IFA is, A, it's a public show. You don't like shows with a public get entry, do we, Steve?
God, no. Well, I was playing German metal band T-shirt bingo on the Friday.
Right. Right. Did you miss it this year, Ed?
Well, the idea of going in my present condition would have been pretty nightmarish. I quite like IFA, but then I quite like Berlin. And I also like the fact that it's just, you know, you can do a big hall of televisions, turn a corner and there's someone doing a cooking demonstration. I've always quite liked the sheer randomness of it.
Yeah, it is a lot more lifestyle and yeah, white very. Goods orientated. It always has been. It's always been one of those shows. And AV is just an add-on. Although it's
very small part of it, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
but not as small as Bristol, let's be fair. But yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love Berlin as well, Ed, and I like the whole thing, and I love Currywurst, and I haven't had Currywurst for a couple of years now. I had a couple of years since I was last at IFA, but it is one of these shows where it just happens at the wrong time of the year if you're a manufacturer, because it's Q3 and you've already announced your product for the whole year. You've done that at CES, and I guess, you know, apart from 77 inch versions of TVs we've already reviewed, Steve, there wasn't anything majorly groundbreaking, was it? I mean, Toshiba's coming back to the market. We'll talk about that in a little bit because that's good news. But there's nothing groundbreaking in everything we've seen. I've seen video clips of the LG stand. That could have been at CES because it was an identical stand.
I mean, I went to the LG, you know, they did a little, basically like a stand tour, and I went along, but I really wish I hadn't bothered because I had so little time and there was absolutely nothing new at that stand at all. Now, to be fair to LG, why bring out anything new? You've had a cracking year. You know, they had the W7 on show. They had the 77-inch version there as well, which I don't think I'd seen at that point. But, that was heavily on display because it is really, eye-catching for general consumers coming to the show. Like, blimey, look at that. But, you know, they've had a cracking year. They were talking about the fact they support HLG and HDR10 and Dolby Vision. And they've had really big sales numbers. They've been dropping their prices. And they've been, apparently, from what I've been hearing from the manufacturers, really getting market share out of this and really edging Samsung in terms of overall market share in the higher end. So OLED's been an absolute storming success for them this year, as is seen by also the other manufacturers coming on board in terms of doing OLED TVs as well. So they didn't really need to announce anything new. They'd had a cracking year. They were just celebrating the fact they had a really good year, and that's fair enough. But in terms of obviously us reporting new stuff, bit of a waste of time. In terms of other manufacturers, though, there was some good stuff. So first of all, we'll go through with Philips. They announced 65-inch version of their existing 9002, which membership saw the 55-inch version quite recently, that shootout. And they also announced their new QLED TV, so they're going to be getting quantum dot onto their LED LCD TVs as well. They weren't necessarily calling it QLED, but I mean, that's the kind of the general generic name it's become now. But it was an LED LCD TV.
I did notice that TCL were using QLED.
Yeah, it's definitely catching on as a phrase, which I'm sure will delight Samsung. But yeah, it's the 8602. That's going to be a quantum dot LED LCD TV. And they also announced now this was a little bit confusing because obviously they had the 9002 and the 902F already announced, and they announced a 9 series, but it is a different TV. OLED again, 55 and 65-inch screen sizes, but this one has like a speaker base, a sound base, rather than the 9002, which has sort of built-in speakers. That will be coming Q1. So it was nice to see them getting on. Obviously, that means they've had three different ranges of OLEDs now, so they're really getting into OLED quite heavily, but still doing LED LCD as well. Obviously, they were showing a lot of their Ambilight products, which again, a lot of people are big fans of. So that was quite good. Went over to Panasonic. Panasonic, obviously, aside from the whole Samsung Fox HDR10 Plus thing, their stand again was pretty, there wasn't much there. It wasn't new. The only thing that was, I guess, new was a 77-inch version of the EZ1002. So that's Panasonic, not much there. But obviously Technics, if you want to use, that's a different brand, did have a bit of news. Ed, I'm going to pass over to you now because I know this has really excited you.
Yeah, well, this is, if you like, the missing piece to a puzzle.
Well, this was the worst kept secret ever as well. But...
well, yes. When, however many years ago it was, that Technics announced that they were bringing they were going back into turntable production. The prototype that they showed was a platter spinning, and it was essentially a working cutaway, and it didn't look like an SL1200. It still doesn't. It looked like a different Technics turntable. It looked like an SP10. And we sort of looked at it, and then obviously the announcement came that there was the SL1200 GAE and then G. But all the time, it's like it was a clear, and you know, I've alluded to this in the review I did of the GR, that many parts of these new turntables had more in common with this reference turntable from the 70s and 80s, and they did the SL1200. And needless to say, announced this time round is the SP10R. And well, on a number of levels, this is a big deal. This is a return of a device which is still considered by many people who aren't, you know, insane when they say this, to be a reference point in vinyl reproduction. It's also a multinational company moving not only into sort of, if you like, opportunistic nostalgia, which you could argue is the case with the SL1200s. This is, generally speaking, companies like this do not do these things for sentimentality purposes. Yeah. This is a big deal.
No, I think we need to explain exactly what the SP is to people who are not aware, just so it makes sense to them. So this turntable, it was used primarily in this country as a professional broadcast turntable. So this is going back to radio stations like Radio 1 and the BBC stations, that when vinyl was the big thing that it was, they used these turntables. Now, it's not a turntable in the traditional sense where you get a tone arm and everything's built into one chassis. You don't get any of that. So just explain how this is put together, Ed, because the thing that gets most people when they see photos is, where's the tone arm?
Where's the rest of it? Yes, the SP10 as a model number pertained to the platter, motor, housing and the power supply. And there was nothing else. Now, that sounds very bizarre in modern parlance. I mean, we can just about get our heads around the fact that there are modern turntables which you don't, when you buy it, you don't get the arm. That's sort of understood, and you can choose the arm for it. But Technics sold the SP10 as a device, which, as you say, could be dropped into monitoring desks and items like that, and essentially used in whatever configuration with as many arms and other devices that the purchaser saw fit. It's important to stress that when this was sold the first time round, there was a plinth and arm option, and that was sold as a standalone unit, although far fewer were sold in this configuration than you might expect. Most owners were quite content to go and choose their own accoutrements for it. So I don't know if Steve's going to fill in on this, but there, at the moment, there seems to be very little detail on what additional hardware, if any, is being worked on by Panasonic to go with the 2018 launch of this thing. And
as far as I could tell, Ed, looking at the thing at the show, none, because there was just the... I was wondering about that. I was thinking, where is the... I was thinking, does it come out from the body or something? Because there was no tone arm at all, and no indication of anyone being planned. It's just the SP10R, the body of the turntable, basically.
I mean, my gut feeling is they're going to produce something. It will be interesting to see whether they consider that to be how they're going to sell many of them, or if they are sticking to their convictions and going for it as a pro unit.
This is low volume. Absolutely low volume. Cost a lot. I'm going to be brave and put a price on it now.
Price for it?
I'm going to be brave and suggest a price of 10 grand.
I think 8 to 10 is realistic on this, yes.
Yeah, so it's going to be really low number, really niche. So, you know, they might produce something, but if they're only going to sell a few, Ed, then I would think they're just going to leave it to whoever purchases it to find their own solutions.
Well, there are plenty of companies out there, and they have been pretty clever. As I understand it, it is, as best as anyone can work out, to the millimetre, the same size as original Mark IIs and Mark IIIs.
Yeah, they actually had them there. They had three of the older ones, old previous generations in a row next to it. and they're almost identical.
Yeah. So there are already companies out there which make plinths out of a variety of materials, and you can, and when I say variety, everything from carbon fiber space frames through to slate. A friend of mine had an SP10 in a slate plinth. It weighed a little under 200 kilos in that configuration, which meant moving it around was quite exciting. So yeah, there's already our options out there in most countries. So we'll see what comes of it. But yes, it's extremely specialized. But equally, from Panasonic's perspective, once this thing is in production and ticking over, unlike so many other parts of their consumer electronics divisions, it can be left to run. You know, it has sunk costs, as you might expect, but it, you know, we're not going to be expecting a revised model next year and things like that. It gives manufacturers the opportunity to get a line of products in place which can tick over and earn revenue on a level that the televisions and stuff simply don't permit you to do.
Yeah, well, you know, this is low volume but high markup stuff that you're talking about here, and it's interesting that the parts are also shared across the SL1200 line as well. So, you know, they're making some cost savings there. And if these do come in at 10 grand, that, you know, that's a nice markup for a manufacturer who is showing faith in the market and bringing this type of thing back. It could be that it's not wanted, but seeing the success they had with the limited edition 1200s, I think they'll sell out each year's allocation, no problem whatsoever.
I think that's probably fair. And I've got to be honest, I couldn't wait. I was desperate to have a go. I mean, some of the specs of the original SP10s. I mean, obviously, we talk about the SL1200 as having ridiculous pitch stability. The SP10, you can apply something in the order of, it works out as getting on for a 1 ton per square inch force to the platter before it starts to slow down, which is gloriously pointless, but that's in the not pissing about school of analog replay. So, yeah. I mean, for me, this was the most intriguing product of the show, because it's an ill-kept secret, but I was almost prepared to accept that, you know, they'd used SP10 DNA in the new 1200s and that they were going to leave it at that. This is quite a strong move by Panasonic, so it'll be interesting to see how they get on with it.
And again, it shows you what, you know, the type of faith that they have in the European market, because every IFA for the last 3 years or 4 years has had a major announcement from Technics.
Yes.
Yeah. So they have really focused on Europe. And to be honest, I don't even think you can get the stuff in the States. I think it's a bit like the TVs over there now. I'm not even sure you can get Technics branded stuff over there. So it's really good to see that they're keeping faith with the European market. And obviously there is a market there, because like we say, the limited edition turntables in the past, they've sold out their allocation, you know, and they could have probably sold out 3 or 4 times over. So great to see that happening. So let's move on. So newcomers back to the market, Steve, Japanese brand, yeah, but this time owned by Vestal.
Indeed. Well, actually, that's just to clarify, Vestal have bought the rights to the brand name for the European market, but they do still involve, the TVs are actually designed by both Vestal and Toshiba. So this is Toshiba making a comeback, and they wanted to make it very clear that it's not just a Vestal TV. There is Toshiba design work and tech within these TVs as well, which I think is good news. I mean, that's an interesting combination. So they realize, you know, that Toshiba do still have value and things they can add to the process. So it's not just them buying the brand name and then doing a bunch of their TVs branded as Toshiba. So that's something they wanted to make quite clear. And I think that's an interesting fact. In terms of the actual lineup that they announced, they had, they've got the U6 and the U7, which are basically LED LCD TVs, but they also announced their OLED TV, which I've got to say looked really good, and that will include Dolby Vision. So again, another manufacturer supporting that. And they also had some concept stuff on the show as well, and something that I saw a lot of at the show, which is obviously the W7's having an impact in terms of design thoughts, because even though these concept models weren't OLEDs, they were actually LED LCD panels, they were going for the very minimalist, just stick the panel on the wall and have everything else in a separate box. And that was something that Toshiba was showing as well. I thought that the new range looked very good, and I thought the OLED in particular looked very impressive. And so I think it's exciting to have a manufacturer like that back in the marketplace. It was a shame to see them go before. And that's good news.
Steve, there's rumours coming out of the show, certainly on Twitter, that this OLED's going to be under $2,000.
Yes, I think pricing has largely been set by LG at this point, with the B7 now selling for $2,000. For example, Philips, their 55-inch 9002, when that comes out later this month in the UK, will be $2,000. And if Toshiba are going to, you know, if they're going to get any sales, they have to basically target $2,000 or less for it to be, you know, for it to make any impact currently, because otherwise it's just, people are just going to go for the LG at $2,000. So I think we're going to see all the manufacturers are going to have to start dropping their prices and coming in fairly low in order to get some market share.
Yeah, and if LG really are getting the market share, which we're being told behind the scenes they are getting, and you know, they can get that volume out there in terms of OLED, and as we're seeing now, they're now supplying other manufacturers, adding competition. It won't be a race to the bottom, but it certainly makes OLED more of a viable proposition for more and more consumers as the years go on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. The pricing, and obviously the fact you've got more choice now, and clearly LG are managing to produce enough panels to meet demand, which is also key, because otherwise there's always a danger of bottleneck when you've only got one manufacturer of the panels themselves. They're obviously making enough now it can only be good for consumers. You're going to see lower prices, you're going to see more choice, and OLED is now becoming a mass market product in a way that it wasn't before. I think once you get below $2,000, yes, it's still expensive, don't get me wrong, but I think that's approaching a price point where people who maybe wouldn't initially consider OLED as an option will think, well, maybe I should get an OLED TV, because I mean, they look great. I mean, when you see one in a shop or anywhere, you think, blimey, look at the picture on that. Now, in terms of the announcements about larger screen sizes, I actually asked Philips, you know, is there any reason why you didn't announce 65-inch earlier? And they said, you just couldn't get hold of any. So clearly, 65-inch and 77-inch, the later announcements on these products is because of panel supply restrictions, from LG Display, which I guess is understandable. They can only make so many at a time, and presumably LG get first dibs. So, it looks like they're meeting demand, certainly in the 55-inch screen size, definitely, for all their manufacturers who need panels, and also for LG themselves, who, as I say, from what I've been hearing behind the scenes, LG have been absolutely storming it this year, and Samsung have had an absolute mare, and their sales have fallen off a cliff. So, interesting that there's been this sort of change in dynamic over the last 12 months. The other famous name that's making a comeback into the European market is Sharp. Now, this was a really interesting story, because I actually met with UMC/Sharp at last year's IFA, when UMC, who are a European TV manufacturer, had bought the rights to the Sharp name for Europe. Since that time, Foxconn bought Sharp, and then Sharp bought UMC. So what was originally UMC buying the Sharp brand for Europe, UMC is now owned by Sharp/Foxconn, and therefore are making the panels for them. But it's basically Sharp making a return to the marketplace as a genuine company again, rather than just as a brand being used by another manufacturer. So that's very interesting. Now, they didn't have much on at the moment. They did say, they were quite honest and said, look, this is our first TVs. These aren't that great. We're going to, you know, we're looking to, you know, develop this much quicker in next year. They did have a few concepts on show. And again, wallpaper TVs, you know, these thin LED, LCD panels were being shown. But their big thing, and it's something Sharp's been very big in, for a few years now, they were really pushing the whole 8K concept, and they had it was the world's first 8K TV. So it's a TV in Japan and in Taiwan. In other words, it's got a tuner built in. In Europe, it's going to be a monitor without a tuner, because obviously there are no 8K broadcasts, so what's the point? So it was an 8K monitor for Europe. It's going to be out later this year. I said, well, has it got HDMI 2.1 then? I said, no. I said, well, how do you... I don't know where you're going to get an 8K source from. But assuming you can find an 8K source, how are you going to get it into the TV? And they said, oh, well, you're using a quad HDMI input. A quad HDMI input is basically four HDMI inputs at the back with four cables going in, feeding this 8K signal into the telly. I can't see that being a massive seller right now.
No, but I have to do it, Steve, because Japan hold the next Olympics, and they promised, or NHK have certainly promised, that it will be the first Olympics that is broadcast in 4K.
Yeah.
And being as you're talking about a Japanese company, really, they have to do it.
Like I say, that's why in Japan and Taiwan, it is a TV with a tuner built in, and it will be receiving, as you said, Phil, 8K broadcasts in 2020 at least. And I guess they're doing tests before then. I think they've been doing some already. So maybe there it's a viable product, but I think anywhere else it isn't. We're struggling just to get 4K going at the moment. And, you know, a lot of movies are still finished in 2K, as many members point out, when the discs are being reviewed. So the idea of 8K being a viable product at the moment, I think they're just trying to show their expertise in this area, but clearly it's not something that's going to be selling in any kind of numbers.
Yeah, totally.
Outside of Japan.
Yeah, and it's a technological achievement for the Japanese broadcaster and the nation for them to do that. So they can be seen to be back at the... You know, they've been taking an absolute kicking from the Koreans over the years recently, so it gives them a pedestal to stand on and say, look, we can still innovate and look at this, we're doing stuff in 8K. But like you say, for the rest of the planet, if it does come, it's at least a decade away, if not longer.
Yeah. Speaking of newcomers, Hisense had their stand. Now, nothing new there in terms of the current lineup. So they had the N6800, which we've already reviewed, the N8700, which we'll be getting quite soon to review, and the N9700, which we'll also be getting quite soon to review. They did have their laser TV on show, which is a short throw laser with a screen, which we've seen, I think, at least two shows. The last two EFAs that have been, yep, been out, but it's coming to the UK, about $5,000. That'll be coming out between now and the end of the year.
$5,000, now that is not bad. When you consider that Sony are doing one which is, I think it's about 18 to 20.
Yeah.
And certainly the ones that have come to market even before that have been, you know, you're talking $20,000. To come in at $5,000 for a solution like that, that's, I can see that being really appealing to a lot of custom installers out there as well.
Yeah, if you want big screen, you know, you can get a pretty big screen without all the gubbin, you know, having a projector in the room, but because obviously it's right next to the wall, basically, it doesn't take much space. Yes, it's definitely, I think that's definitely going to appeal to people at that price point.
Yeah, and it's a great solution for pubs and clubs as well, Steve.
It is indeed, yeah, it is indeed. They also had some interesting, again, like Sharp and Toshiba, they had an ultra-thin LED LCD TV attached to the wall with a separate soundbar unit, which I've got to say looked very attractive. And they did mention that they were going to be moving into the soundbar market in quite a big way going forward, because they've realized it's, you know, it's a huge market. And so they're going to be doing their own soundbars. So they got that. They also had, and this was really interesting, they had, it was a concept, but it was a 1,000-zone LED LCD TV that could deliver 2,200 nits. So they're certainly pushing the, and they're one of the few manufacturers, I have to say, that's still looking, along with Sony, that's still doing and developing direct LED backlight TVs, because obviously most manufacturers, and this was evident at the show, but also has been said to us behind the scenes, is the problem is when consumers see OLEDs, they do not want thick tellies. So direct LED TVs, which by definition have to be a bit deeper than a normal LED LCD TV, because there's LEDs behind the panel, they're not selling, because consumers want thin, really thin TVs like OLEDs. And that's why we've seen so few direct LED FALD TVs this year. And that seems to be a continuing trend, but Hisense at least were still working on that. They're also obviously introducing Quantum Dot onto their TVs next year, so they're going to be doing that as well. And they have their own branded TV, because they're a sponsor of the World Cup next year in Russia, so they've got a World Cup. They're the official makers of the World Cup TV. So they're definitely doing some interesting things, which is good to see. And then moving over to the Sony stand, they didn't have anything really new in terms of TVs. They just had a 77-inch version of the A1. But they always announced their new projector lineup at IFA. This year was no exception. So we had an interesting lineup, actually, because they had the VW260, which is basically going to be a much cheaper entry-level 4K, native 4K projector to kind of go up against the likes of Epson and JVC, and et cetera. And also all the new DLP projectors that are coming through that you've been seeing, Phil. So that's going to be around about, well, they will do everything in euros, but I can assume it's going to be a one-to-one comparity here, about 5,000 euros, 5,000 quid. Then there was the VW 560, and they had the VW 760, which is a native 4K laser projector, which is going to be around about 15,000, which is a big drop in price compared to the JVC Z1 or Sony's. No, it's only about the size. It's not much bigger than the current 4K projectors.
Okay.
Very similar. So yes, you know, not gigantic like the VW 5000 Sony or the Z.
So I should be able to carry it up my stairs then.
You can review it. Yes, you can fit it in. You'll be glad to know. So I got a demo of that projector, and they did point out this was a pre-production model. It wasn't the finished article yet because it's not coming out till later in the year, and this is about 80%. They said about 80% finished, so they were still working on things like some of the black levels and some of the contrast and this sort of stuff. But it looked pretty good. I mean, like any projector, it only had 2,000 lumens peak brightness, so you know HDR content didn't have the punch you would get on a TV. And it had the elevated black floor that you'd expect really with HDR content, but you know, native 4K laser projection it's not going to dim, it's going to last for 10-15,000 hours. So you haven't got to change bulbs. So there's lots of advantages, and obviously it's a much cheaper price point than previous. Where I mean, talking about 35,000 for the Z1, and I think 50,000 for the VW 5000. So a big difference in price. Also good to see that Sony are trying to get native 4K projection down to a lower price point with the BW260.
They are the only native chips out there at the minute. I mean, even the DLP are doing the pixel shift with theirs, so it's not it's not a native projector. JVC and Epson, they're all doing the pixel shift stuff. So in terms of being a native projector, Sony are the only game in town and have been for the last 4 or 5 years. So it kind of makes the JVC news a bit like, oh, really?
Well, JVC, you can back me up on this, Phil, right? Did they not call us 2 weeks ago and say, we've got nothing at EFA apart from a pair of headphones? I said, oh, okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
And then they go and announce 3 projectors. Like, thanks, boys. Now, I've got to say, looking at the specs, it's basically the same as last year with a tiny iteration. I mean, it was eShift version 5 now, I think, was the only difference. And there's that 20th anniversary model, which is in bright red.
Yeah.
Interesting choice of colour.
corporate colour. So that's why it's red, yes, you see. So.
Yes. So that was a bit disappointing from JVC, I have to say. And I think that was
although they are the only, them and Epson, even though they do the pixel shift, where they do score against the native projectors at the minute is with their black levels and shadow detail and so on. So it'll be interesting to see, certainly the new lineup of Sony's, I'm really interested to see all three of those projectors and just see how they handle, with certainly the laser machine, how they handle where the black floor is in them, and do they still compete and do they still look cinematic, which is the main point of having a projector and a projected image.
Yeah, I mean, I think I totally agree that whilst JVC perhaps haven't been pushing the boundaries much and pushing the envelope in terms of development of a native 4K panel, for example, or that sort of thing, when you look at all the other factors that they do with their projectors so well, I think the size of the color gamut, the black levels, the full fat 18 gig inputs, it still delivers an image that looks fantastic with 4K. And even though it's not native, it can hold its own against the Sony's.
Yeah, normal seating distance, we've said this umpteen times and we've done the testing and we're confident enough to back it up. Get yourself at a normal seating distance from these projectors, and if you didn't know which was which, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart resolution-wise anyway. It would be other attributes that would tell you which is which.
If you're interested in laser and you don't have 15 grand knocking around, obviously there's already the Epson laser projector, which was at the show, but that's been around for a couple of years. And then I think Optoma have also announced a laser 4K DLP projector, which I'm sure will be of interest as well, because it's going to be a lot cheaper than 15,000 quid, giving you the benefits of the longer life and the consistency of a laser as opposed to a bulb. So that'll be interesting to see.
The disappointment thing is it's still no sharks. Still no sharks for lasers. Come on, people.
So that was it, really, for the show. I think overall there was some interesting stuff there. But like you say, Phil, with there only being 3 months now until everyone starts gearing up for CES, it's time. And obviously, as Ed's pointed out previously, Munich's become the big hi-fi event of the year worldwide. The Munich show is where hi-fi goes. CES is the sort of big consumer electronics show for the year ahead. IFA's kind of stuck between those two, and therefore a lot of it tends to be more about, there were some phone announcements, that kind of stuff, and obviously white goods. But on the AV side of things, it's definitely
Yeah, but the
becoming
other thing
less
is,
and less important.
The other thing is, though, it is a public show, and it's the only major show of the year that is open. It opens its doors to non-trade people, and you've got to remember that this is probably the first time that these people, the public, get to see the gadgets that we saw back in CES that haven't been released yet. This is the only chance they really get to really see them up close and personal. So from that perspective, it is a big show, and it always has been a big show for the public. And like I say, white goods wise, I don't know what was announced, but I'm sure there were some pretty big announcements when it comes to white goods and cooking and all that kind of thing, and beauty and so on, which are you know, growing and growing just as quickly as the AV side of the businesses are.
I could certainly vouch for the size of the show, because you can never get appointments to line up so that you're near each other. You know, like that's in Hall 20, that's in Hall 18. It's always Hall 20, then right over the other side of IFA for Hall 6,
yep.
And then right back over again for Hall 22, then right over to Hall 5. Bloody exhausting.
Yeah, and then you've got, it's on two floors as well, so you've got an upper floor and a lower floor as well, yeah. So it can get quite confusing. And in terms of real estate, it's about the same size as the Las Vegas Convention Center as well. So, except you get more packed into CES, then it tends to be companies taking over the entire hall at IFA. But still a lot of walking.
Well I did 10 miles on Friday. I have my little watch told me. It's a fair bit of walking involved.
Yeah,
I suppose it keeps me fit. Keeps me fit.
That'd have been about 20,000 steps, was it, Steve?
Yeah, about that. Yeah. 20,000 steps and no lunch. That's all I can say.
What, you went all day and you didn't have any currywurst?
I had no time. I didn't have a lot of time. Basically, I had a couple of croissants at breakfast, and then it was just non-stop until I got on the coach to the airport, and then I had to wait around.
Yeah, at your age, Steve, you have to make time to eat. You're not a youngster anymore.
Annoyingly, my flight out was delayed, and my flight back was delayed because of the bomb they found at Frankfurt. So. Which was a British bomb, so thanks a lot, boys.
To be very clear, though, they're not overstating the risks.
I know, it's
this.
A 1.5-ton bomb, isn't it?
It's a 4,000... It's a cookie, which is even worse, because they were never designed to be unexploded bombs. Their thin casing is basically, it looks like an enormous heating boiler filled with ammetol. And essentially, even if they didn't explode, they would shatter, and then the explosives would be consumed by other bombs going off nearby. To find an unexploded one is extremely bad news, especially after this length of time. So massive, massive respect to the people who are having to deal with it, and I do fervently wish them all the best in getting it sorted.
I didn't realise there's a full, Germany have got a full team of unexploded bomb experts who work full-time, because they're constantly finding these bombs,
yes,
in Germany. And that since 2000, I think something like 15 of them have been killed. So those are technically still people being killed by World War II.
Yeah, it's not necessarily. I mean, you know, massive respect to them, and it's this one really isn't to be taken lightly.
It would take out like a whole street if it went off then.
It's really not good news at all, and it's very, very close to the gold reserves as well. So there's the added point that you can also vaporize the consolidated wealth of, you know, the
ECB.
financial engine of Europe. So yeah, it's going to take them a little while to sort, and I do really hope they get it squared away.
Okay, can I move on to movies now? Have we finished? All right, movie news next. Okay, so moving on to movie news. So we're going to be quick with this. So apologies in advance. But I did get to go and see Terminator 2 3D on the big screen. It was so popular that Odeon are showing it all this week, Steve. So there is an opportunity for you to go and see it if you want to go and see it. And I would highly recommend it, because the 3D, even though it is a conversion job, was really quite good. Nothing jarring. Nothing that seemed out of place. Basically, it gave the effect that the screen went backwards, if that makes sense, in terms of depth. So there was nothing poking out the screen at you or anything like that that was gimmicky or in any way. And it was really nicely done. And I have to say, the new colour timing and the film itself looked absolutely stunning. It was pristine. Detail levels and faces and so on was astonishingly good. It just looked fabulous. It really did. And the new colour timing, it kept all the blues and the blacks and stuff. that we become accustomed to. There was a bit more, there was a better definition to it, which I think in HDR is going to look really nice as well. Yeah, so I can't wait to get the 4K disc, which I believe has been delayed again.
Yes, I was going to come on to that in the Ultra HD Blu-ray news.
Okay,
but it's we might as well do it now, I suppose. Yeah, it was originally going to come out on the originally going to come out in the States on the 3rd of October. It's now coming out on the States on the 31st of October, so it's been basically been delayed by nearly a month. The actual release date for the UK, I'm going to assume, is going to be similar, but actually hasn't been announced yet anyway. So I'm guessing that will probably end up being the 31st as well.
Probably, or maybe even in November. But anyway, it's worth the wait, people. And if you get the opportunity to go and see it this week, while it's on at the Odeon, and it will be on till Thursday of this week until they redo everything for the Fridays, if you can get in to see a screen and go and see it, it is fabulous. And I have to say, I saw it in the screen on that evening. It was absolutely jam-packed. I haven't seen the cinema as busy as that in a long, long time. All fans of the film. So it was just a great atmosphere, absolutely fantastic atmosphere. So yeah, absolutely brilliant. Really enjoyed it, and it took me back 25 years. Can you believe 25 years?
Jesus. Was it 91?
91, wasn't it?
Yeah, so 26, 20, bloody hell.
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, Judgment Day was 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, I remember going to... And, it was one thing that really struck me seeing it this time around in the cinema, which, you know, you forget. And I was thinking back to the first time I saw the film and the whole reveal that Arnie's not the bad guy. You kind of forget that because you've seen it so many times over the 20 odd years. But you forget that when you went in to see that film initially, you weren't aware that Arnie was the good guy when the characters are first introduced. So yeah,
kind of assume the cop, you know, the other robot is the guy.
You think he's the good guy, like he was in the original. So, yes, from that perspective and looking at it through fresh eyes and thinking, well, I was seeing this fresh at the time and I didn't know that Arnie was the good guy and so on, until it was revealed in the film. It's great. Somebody said on the forums they would love to be able to have their mind wiped for films.
Yeah.
It's called many
other things in my life would be quite good too, I think.
That's exactly what I was thinking, Steve.
And obviously you weren't offended by the sight of Robert Patrick's nutsack.
Didn't see any of that. Yeah. I saw the bit you were on about the windscreen not coming out. I specifically watched.
Looking for that,
yeah. But I didn't notice anything else being cleaned up and so on, but it does look really, really nice. Yeah.
That's a disc I'm looking forward to. Yeah. DTSX soundtrack as well, so that should sound pretty stunning.
And I also contacted Odeon on their Facebook because Close Encounters is not listed at any cinemas at the minute.
Apparently it's showing, though. I think
it is, but I was told it was wink, wink, nudge, nudge, just keep checking the website.
Right.
So announcements will be coming.
It is listed in IMDb. It's coming out next week, so obviously they are going to do some screenings. That's great news. I'd love to see that again at the cinema. I saw that in 77, but...
I want to see it cleaned up and shown again. Absolutely.
And in fact, actually, since you brought it up, I was also going to mention this in the Ultra HD Blu-ray news, but the Ultra HD Blu-ray, which comes out on the... Let me just get the date right. This is the States, at least. Comes out on the 19th of September, so not long, a couple of weeks. That will include all three versions. So the theatrical cut, the extended cut, and the... what's it called? The theatrical cut, the special edition, and the... Is it called the final cut, or what do they call it? Anyway, The final version that Spielberg did, all three versions will be on the disc in HDR and 4K and everything. So, great news there. Nice to see that they're giving us the option of watching all different versions.
Yeah. Okay, so if we're going to the cinema this week, Steve, what can we see?
One big release this week, which is It, the remake of the Stephen King novel about Pennywise the Clown, which I've got to say, I mean, I know the story from having read the book when I was a kid and watching the original version with Tim Curry as Pennywise. This looks pretty good. This looks really scary in the trailers. So I probably will go and see it because I do quite enjoy watching a horror film with an audience. It's often a really good laugh. Everyone's screaming together and that sort of stuff. So
you just want to go along because it's the only time you get to scream like a girl.
Actually, no, you should see me playing Resident Evil on the PSVR if you want to see me screaming like a big girl.
We do. So on to YouTube with you. Anyway, I digress.
So that's what's coming out this week anyway. It's one big release, but I'm sure that will be popular.
Okay, so let's move on to Blu-rays and UHD Blu-rays then.
Big release this week is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. That's both Blu-ray and Ultra HD Blu-ray. I've already got my copy. I was watching it yesterday, and it looks absolutely stunning. Absolutely stunning. This is the first Ultra HD Blu-ray release from Disney, and they haven't put a foot wrong. They've delivered the goods in terms of picture quality and sound quality. Dolby Atmos soundtrack as well, and the picture quality. The color gamut, the detail. I mean, it is a 2K DI with upscale to 4K, I believe. But you know, it just looks so much more detailed than the Blu-ray, and just the colors and the HDR on the OLED. It looked absolutely stunning. So I'm really pleased with that. That's the big release. But also out this week, we have Mindhorn, which I've seen and is really funny. Basically, it's basically like a Mickey take of Bergerac, where this actor who played a detective on a TV show set on the Isle of Man, as a guy kidnaps somebody who thinks that Mindhorn is a real person and demands to only speak to Mindhorn. So they have to bring this washed-up actor back to the Isle of Man in order to play the part, in order to talk to this guy, and the police bring him along. And it's very funny. I really enjoyed it. Written and starring the guys who did things like Mighty Boosh. Also, we got The Flash Season 3. I've not seen any of the DC comics TV stuff. I've only seen the movie stuff. But I have heard that the comic stuff on TV is actually really good. And The Flash is one of the best of the series. And that's in its third season now, and worth checking out if you're into that. And also, if you don't have Netflix somehow, you've got Narcos Season 2, which is also out on Blu-ray this week. And then we've already mentioned Terminator and Close Encounters. But new announcements for Ultra HD Blu-ray. War for the Planet of the Apes, that's coming out in the States at least on the 24th of October. And also Baby Driver has the new release date, 10th of October for Baby Driver in the States. So a couple of announcements there.
That trip to Fry's is getting more expensive as the weeks go on.
You better take a big bag.
Yep.
That's it. So I mean we're at this, the next 3 months into Christmas, basically there's a lot of really decent films coming out on Ultra HD Blu-ray, a lot of good catalog titles as well. ET is next week, week after next rather, in the States, and I think in the UK as well. So that's I'm definitely getting that, and there's really good titles coming up.
It's good, and it's good that it's, you know, these are now getting released as it's getting dark at night and as the weather starts to turn. And well, I'm saying the weather starts to turn. We haven't really had a summer, but you know what I mean. when it gets more grey than it has been, and when the rain is not warm, it's actually cold. That's when you know you're getting into autumn and winter. So
I'll have plenty to watch, I think, because like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I did meet with the Blu-ray Disc Association to talk about Ultra HD Blu-ray, which has been going absolutely gangbusters, way better than they.
Yeah, that's mainly been... you.
Granted, but they were
Did they have the red carpet out for you arriving, Stephen? Thank you very much for supporting this market. And
it was funny because they basically said, you know, TV, obviously 4K TV sales have gone through the roof, so that's good news for them. Plenty of players in the marketplace now, lots of different manufacturers. We've got Dolby Vision, of course, which is good news. All the studios now, because obviously Disney are on board now, so all the studios are supporting it. Sales are going really well. They've had 170 discs released, different titles released in the States so far this year. And he was saying there's going to be another 170 between now and the end of the year, so they're really starting to ramp up in terms of titles. And it was all good news. So that was made me pleased. I did say it's costing me a fortune, but I did ask them, is there any particular reason why the release dates seem to be so big? It's such a big difference in dates between the US and UK release dates. And there was a guy from Warner's there, and to be fair to Warner's, they haven't been doing that. Their titles haven't been coming out day and date in the States and the UK. For example, I forgot to mention it, also out this week, Blade Runner. Also out this week, both in the US and the UK. My disc arrived early, and I've watched that, and that is absolutely stunning. It is the best this film has ever and certainly will ever look. They did a full 4K restoration, 8K scan for the special effects shots that were shot on 65mm HDR pass, and it just looks amazing. And the Dolby Atmos soundtrack is also top draw. So if you're a fan of Blade Runner, get it.
I'm already salivating at the thought of it, Steve.
Yes, honestly, it just looks stunning. So that's also out this week, along with Guardians of the Galaxy. So two big Blu-ray releases, Ultra HD Blu-ray releases this week. But yeah, so the Warner Brothers guy was just saying, you know, he said their titles are coming out at the same time, but he didn't have any. He said maybe, I guess it's not because of language issues, because most of it was, we actually just used the US disc for the UK, something that was proven when I put on Blade Runner and the FBI warning came up. So it's interesting. No BBSC, just an FBI warning. But he didn't know. They couldn't really explain why there's that delay. But it's definitely become noticeable over the last 6 months that there seems to be less titles in the UK. Obviously, it's, I think, been more successful in the States.
I have to say, I was looking at Amazon earlier on, and I have been looking at a couple of other places that have a £2 for £30 offer on at the minute. And I have to say, you're saying that, Steve, but a lot of these are now starting to appear on their websites for the UK releases. So they are coming. It's just, for whatever reason, it's just taking a lot longer. But I think in the run-up to Q4 and Christmas, I think we're going to see a whole load of them ending up on the market quite quickly here, I think.
Yeah, it's my only complaint about Blade Runner, by the way, and this is nitpicking, it's nothing to do with the film. The film absolutely stunning, is that they could have included Dangerous Days in high def. Would have been nice, because it was shot in high def. The documentary about the making of the film, which lasts for 3.5 hours, that's available with the... Actually, that's interesting. Now, in the UK, I should probably clarify this. In the UK, if you buy it currently, it's got the film, the final cut version, and three commentary tracks on the Ultra HD Blu-ray, and it also comes with the Blu-ray of that, with the film and three commentary tracks, and that's it on the UK release. There will be a special edition coming, I think, next month, that will include more stuff, and also the month after, a Steelbook version. But in the US, if you buy it, it's the film, the final cut, on Ultra HD Blu-ray and also on Blu-ray. And also there's a DVD of Dangerous Days and a Blu-ray of the three different versions of the film, the theatrical cut, the international cut, and the director's cut. So the work print is not included, unfortunately. So if you've got the original 5-disc set, keep it.
Yeah. I've got an HD DVD and Blu-ray.
Yeah, me too. But yeah, I thought it would be a nice opportunity to do a because apparently the Blu-ray is identical to the one that was released in 2007. It would be nice to do a new encode of that, because obviously compression's moved on quite a long way in the last 10 years. But also it would have been nice if they'd included Dangerous Days in high def as it was shot on a Blu-ray rather than the DVD that they include, which is just from the original set. So that's nitpicking, though. In terms of the picture and sound of the film itself, absolutely knocks it out of the park.
Okay. And that, unfortunately, is all we've got time for this week.
One last tiny thing, because I didn't get to say it, because we didn't do Album of the Month, for whatever reason. New LCD Sound System album. I will have forgotten it by the end of the month. It came out on Monday. It's absolutely brilliant. Just have a listen. It's fantastic.
Excellent. Well, that is it for the podcast this week. My thanks to Steve Withers.
Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me.
And Ed Selly.
I've taken her to where she wished to go, to meet the man she came here to meet.
I'm Phil Hinton, thank you very much for listening, and everything's back to normal next week.